Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, where you learn what you need to know about how the world wants to work. And now your host, coworking space owner and trend expert, Jamie Russo.
Welcome to the Everything Coworking Podcast, episode number 111. This is Jamie Russo. For those of you that are new to the show, I own a co-working space in Palo Alto, California. I am the executive director of the Global Workspace Association, and through my Everything Coworking brand, I use my broad industry experience to help people start and run co-working spaces that meet their personal and financial goals. By the way, if you ever have questions, send me an email. I love to hear from people. I had an email this week from somebody who is in the LA area. He's originally from Chicago and was looking for some information on niche co-working spaces. And I pointed him in the right direction and referenced a couple of podcast episodes. And I just like to hear from people who are out there because, you know, I don't know who you are unless you send me a note. You are just a download statistic, and that's no good. So feel free to make yourself known if you want to connect. A couple of quick announcements. I have to talk about the GWA conference coming up in September. We just finished our early bird season, and we have just a fantastic group of folks that have already signed up for the conference, including a number of folks from the Everything Coworking Startup School and Flight Groups. We love to get the chance to hang out in person together. And if you are on the fence about making the investment, definitely think about it. It's such a good experience. It's my favorite time of the year. See friends, make new friends, be able to interact with some of the industry's best people and operators who make you think about what you're doing in your business, and then bigger picture, people in the industry who help you understand kind of what's coming down the pipe and what the trends are. So super excited about all the folks that are already attending and would love to see you there. And on a more micro level, we've had some super fun discussions in the Everything Coworking Facebook group in the last week or so. I credit Jerome Chang for starting a discussion about people stealing each other's burritos, like the crazy things that happen in co-working spaces. And people ask lots of business, technical businessy questions. But he started that conversation. I was laughing because I literally thought that I had the only members who steal each other's food. And it totally appalls me. I mean, are we not all adults? And I don't have a camera in the kitchen. And it's been years now, and I keep threatening that I'm going to do it. It feels a little weird to me to have a camera in the kitchen, but come on now. My managers have had their coffee creamer stolen, taken, consumed, maybe stolen's not exactly the right word. Things go missing and it just blows my mind, but apparently this happens everywhere. So anyway, if you want to chat with other people who listen to the podcast, co-working operators, and those getting started, you can join us in the Facebook group, and you can find that at everythingcoworkingclub.com to make that easier. And then I announced this on the last episode. I am super excited. I am working on a new program to support community managers because they are the ones that make it happen, and we don't have any industry training for them. So I'm working on a program to support them, help them understand the industry, and help them get good at what makes their role so important, giving tours, helping with marketing, connecting with members, hosting events, all the things and all the details in each of those buckets that many don't have any experience in and are just learning for the first time. So the program will give them content and training and also a peer group that will be moderated and supported. So we've launched a beta group and we're getting that going, and I will open that up when I feel like we're ready to rock and roll in the next few weeks. If you would like to get on the waiting list for that, www.everythingcoworking.com/community managers. And now to introduce today's guest. Super exciting. I keep saying that. Like I said last time, I think all my guests are super exciting. So I just love how some of these topics come about. So we were talking in one of our flight groups about franchising, and Susan owns a co-working space in Northern Virginia with a business partner. It's called Workaway Solutions. She is also an expert in franchising brands and has been doing this for years. And so she offered to do a phone call with a few people in the flight group. And I said, well, can we also do a podcast? Because I bet there are lots of folks out there who are asking the same questions. So Susan was awesome enough to jump on the phone. And we have a really interesting conversation about her and her business in co-working. She manages a small space with a full-time job. So if you are in that boat, she's going to talk a little bit about how she makes that work. And then she talks about the franchising world. What is it? What does it take to get started? Kind of ballpark budgets for getting a franchise going and sort of some of the benefits and drawbacks. So it's a great conversation, sort of intellectually interesting, even if you're not thinking about franchising. So I hope you enjoy. Thank you for joining us today. I am super excited about today's guest. I'm always excited about my guests, but today is like a two-in-one guest. So I have Susan Glossby with me. She is one of the founders of Workaway Solutions in Northern Virginia. So we're here to talk about co-working, but she also works in the franchising business. So we were on a group call together recently, and the other folks on the call started peppering her with questions about franchising co-working brands. And so then there was a Slack discussion about, you know, having a call about it. And I was like, you know what, let's just do a podcast, because I bet there are other folks who out there who wonder how this works. So we're going to get a two-in-one story today. We're going to get Susan's co-working story, and then we're going to talk about the franchising world and how that applies to co-working and how it works and going to get a good little overview. So Susan, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm always happy to talk co-working and franchising.
Awesome. Okay, so you have an interesting background. Tell us a little bit about, tell us the story of both. How did you get into co-working and how did you get into the franchise world?
So I got into co-working because I wanted a co-working space for me, and it wasn't anything close by. And primarily, I've always worked from home in the franchise space for the last 15 plus years. And it was time for me to get out of the house a little bit more. I was looking into a co-working space and there wasn't anything nearby. So I was like, well, I might as well open one. So
we'll solve that.
I'm here too. So, but I kind of fell into franchising a little bit. My previous life was as a social worker, and I was a military spouse at the time. And I found myself in San Diego and had the opportunity to meet a woman who was starting a pre and postnatal fitness brand, and didn't know at the time that she would franchise it, but we ended up franchising it. And so I helped grow that brand and that team for, gosh, 12 years. So I think, oh my gosh, I've been in franchising since like 2001. So it's been a long time, but mostly in the service sector. So pre and postnatal fitness, I've worked with some senior care brands, kids activity brands. And now I'm in the orthopedic wellness area, actually. So we are franchising an orthopedic wellness brand called Structural Elements. And it is the first franchise brand that is using a co-working model in wellness. Hmm. So yeah, it's been really neat. But so not only are we dealing with franchise law issues, we're dealing with medical issues, right, stuff, and corporate practice of medicine and all these different practice regulations. So by utilizing a co-working model in wellness, it's basically the clinic will be owned by one franchisee, and then each therapist or practitioner in the clinic who's performing our services will also be their own franchised business utilizing the spaces within the clinic. So similar.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a shared cost model where, you know, the clinic franchisee is providing managed services. They're, you know, booking patients, they're taking payments, they're providing all the support to allow a therapist, a chiropractor or a physical therapist, to do what they do best and do their work on their patients and have all the other work be done by someone else, just like a co-working community manager would be helping, you know, facilitate their businesses. So
right.
Pretty neat.
Yeah. Did you have anything to do with that model, or had they come up with that before you crossed paths?
No, we came up that while I was on board. So yeah.
Very interesting. Wait, and so do you do this as an independent expert, or what is your model for this?
So my model with Structural Elements, I had been a consultant with them for about 9 months or so, and then went on full time as VP of operations And we had a few pivots over the last 18 months or so, as far as the model goes, because of these medical regulations that, you know, I wasn't aware of. I know the franchise space, but a lot of these medical issues that had come up around practice. And so, yeah, we landed on this new model. So we're breaking the mold of franchising. Once again, I tend to do that. I tend to go with brands who are changing things up, which is fun.
Yeah.
So it's pretty exciting because the shared cost model makes so much sense, as we know, because that's why we're working owners. So we know that shared cost model works. And so extending that into the wellness space and allowing chiropractors and physical therapists and massage therapists to do what they love and to do what they were trained to do in a space that's, you know, modern and, you know, has all the amenities and do it in a shared cost way is fantastic for everybody involved.
Totally. Don't you just want to apply this model to like everything you run into?
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a tangent, but we were talking on one of our flight group calls. I think Shared Space in Atlanta has, I can't remember the brand name, but they do orthodontist work or they do whitening. So it's something dental related.
Yeah.
But the company's strategy is to locate within co-working spaces. Like they're not taking their own real estate. They're getting offices and they see all their clients. They don't need any special equipment. I think they just do the measuring and yeah. So there's no a special plumbing or I don't know what you need in a dental office, but you don't need any of that. So their strategy is just to locate in co-working spaces, which I think is super interesting. Not the same thing that you're talking about, but again, sort of a creative.
No, very similar. Yeah. Yeah.
Blending. Okay. So we will get into the franchise piece, but I want to talk about you basically work full-time and run a co-working space. And I think there are other people, I'm sure there are other folks listening who are doing that now or like you want to start a space and think, well, I might start a space and still keep my full-time gig. Can you just talk about what does that look like for you? Some of the challenges, trade-offs, you know, considerations people should have if they're thinking about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, luckily I do have a partner. And so she does spend some time at the co-working space as well. Certainly in the beginning, when we were starting our space, it was a bit easier to juggle everything. My space is open 8:30 to 6. And so, you know, also my work day is longer. So even if I'm taking a break to go make the coffee or something like that, there's still plenty of time to, you know, get my full-time work done.
Yeah.
Probably, you know, I've always worked 60 or 70 hours a week. And so it's
oh gosh, okay.
Nothing new for me to have multiple things going on. But certainly once our space started getting busier, it was a little hard to juggle. Now I'm usually there, you know, 2 to 3 days a week. And so I have, you know, the other days I'm home and in my home office focused on my full-time job. But when I am in the space, I do finally now have a part-time employee to help out, which has been really, really nice because, you know, I'm able to get that focused time. And also he's been doing a lot of things for me that, you know, I don't need to do, like, you know, Instagram and doing some and stuff like that. So that's been fantastic having him and also having a partner. I mean, I couldn't do it without having a partner as well.
Just logistically, when you're there, do you sit in the open space?
I do.
Yeah. Okay. So that works. And you don't get 600 interruptions that keep you from actually getting your work done.
I really don't. And I think, you know, part of it is our community, like everyone's super respectful. They know that my partner also has a full-time job. So they know that we're here working too. And, you know, if they see me with headphones on and, you know, they know I'm on a call or they know that, you know, if it's something that can wait, they'll wait and not, you know, write a note or whatever. But I'm also a really small space. So I'm only 1,700 square feet. So it's very different than someone who's running a bigger space and trying to work a full-time job.
Yep.
You know, the number of people in my community on a daily basis are more like 10 or 12 on a busy day. So it's a very different experience too. It's almost like I'm here working and, you know, as my office and I have some office mates.
Totally. Right. Which is
very different.
It is different, although I think that's a model that, I mean, to your point, that was your need, right? And it seems like you love the work that you're doing. It's super interesting. And so, you know, we won't go into for another topic another day. We'll talk about, you know, sort of what the future would look like. But I think there are a lot of people like you who are like, look, I want a community, I want a peer group, and I'll take on the risk of taking a lease and have some people to work with. Yeah. But setting that cultural expectation from the beginning, like I'm not going to hover around waiting to see if you need me to, you know, make you a cup of coffee and bring it to your desk. I mean, it's just a different culture. But when you set that from the beginning and sort of set that, like, look, we're, you know, I'm taking the risk here. I'm making this possible for you, but my headphones are on. I got my day job going here.
Yeah. It's worked out really well. And, you know, like I said, it's, you know, with it being a smaller space, it works, but I can see where if it was a larger space, there's no way it would be possible.
I think too, it gets hard, like when you have more meeting rooms and more external traffic where people need more help and attention, then it gets harder to manage and you have to have.
And I have no intention of leaving my full-time work. Yep. Like, I love my job and I love what I do. And so, you know, that's always going to be a part of me being a space owner. That's just who I am. So.
Yeah. But so that's the thing. I love your, you know, sort of case study, because I think there are other folks who are thinking like, well, could I do both? And is it okay? It's totally okay to have a small space if it's not your primary source of income.
Right.
You know, we talk about this, you know, all the time in our groups. And when I help people with new spaces, you just have to know what you're getting into and, you know, what the potential is. But you can totally have a smaller space and sort of make it, get out of it what you want to get out of if it's not paying your mortgage.
Right. Exactly.
Totally. Okay, great. So let's talk about your work in the franchising world. So I think probably start a little 101 here, because I think maybe people know of some examples of franchising, but I would guess most people don't know anything about how it works. And certainly the fact that, you know, the legal costs and timelines. Mm-hmm. And so kind of walk us through the basics.
Sure. So, and there are probably a lot of brands that people don't realize are franchised. So, you know, when people think franchising, they first think of the food brands.
Yeah, right? Like a McDonald's.
You know, and honestly, I think the last stat I saw, it was less than half of franchise brands are food related. So there's certainly other service type brands of, you know, the maid services and the plumbing and the deck services and the mosquito
painting. Yep.
Painting and all of junk removal and all of those kinds of things. Yeah. And certainly even kids service brands, right? So you think of, you know, brands like Engineering for Kids or...
Is Kumon?
Kumon, yep, exactly. There's some coding ones that are starting up. So all of those kinds of kids activities. Dog services, so, you know, Dogtopia or Camp Bow Wow, those are all franchised brands for boarding and for doggy daycare. So there's a lot of different brands that, you know, and it's a balance, because on the one hand, you know, a franchisee in your community is still a small business owner.
Right.
They invested their money. Yep. They're still part of that community and they are a small business owner, but yet they're operating a brand. And so there's this weird dichotomy of people thinking, oh, well, they're a big company. You know, I'm not supporting
that. That is such a good insight. You're totally right. It's like they are small business owners, just like we are.
Yeah.
They just bought into a brand. But
right.
The brand, I mean, and you talk about this a little bit, like
the
brand provides a certain amount of support, but they're still like in a market on their own trying to figure out how to make it work.
Exactly. So franchising is regulated by the Federal Trade Commission, with 15 states having additional requirements for filing. Federal Trade Commission came upon most of these laws, you know, 20 plus years ago to protect consumers around business opportunities. So there's a lot of regulations around what franchisors are required to provide to their franchisees or potential candidates. So the business model itself, you know, franchising is around because it's a way to scale a business, right? There's certain kinds of businesses that it doesn't make sense for it to be a corporate location. So you think of a clothing store, you know, whether it's Gap or Old Navy or whatever, that's a business model. It's a corporate structure that can, you know, people will go buy clothes to go buy clothes. The businesses such as your maid services, your, you know, dog grooming services, you know, even, you know, some of your restaurants where people want a relationship in their community with that service provider. So there's no way that I could, from a corporate location somewhere, at least from a ridge, there's no way that I could manage, you know, a dog walking service in another state. Like, they don't know me. They're not going to trust their dog to me as a corporate entity. They'll trust a local person in their community who's operating, you know, that business. So it's a way to scale. So partly it's about the business philosophy of, you know, what makes sense to be a corporate entity like a grocery store and what doesn't. The other reason it's a path to scale a business is financial, right? So your franchisees are buying into your business and investing, they're investors in your business to help you scale that business because they're paying their own retirement fund to the franchise in their community and helping you get a footprint across the country without you spending money. You're going to spend money on support and you're going to spend money on legal and you're going to spend money supporting, you know, construction and all of those things for those franchisees. And you're building a long, very long-term revenue stream, but, you know, you're not footing the bill on opening that doggy daycare location that's going to cost $1 million. You're not putting your own $1 million into that store. The franchisee is. So they're building your business is what they're doing.
So the franchisor is kind of serving as the central functions. Like marketing and then, but the local footprint is being created by, the individual.
And invested in. So the trick, you know, the big things about the franchisor is going to provide business systems and processes. You know, they're going to provide, you know, what POS point of sale system they're going to use. They're going to give you the operations manual on how to operate that business. They're going to give you the ability to use their trademarks. They're going to, you know, give you specifications around what that product or service is that you're going to offer. So there's going to be a rule book to follow and there's going to be an operations plan to follow, but you're still putting in your own money as the franchisee. So, you know, you're taking a risk on that franchisor to say, you know, I believe in your business model to invest and open one in my community because I think your business will work here. So it's a balance of risk and a balance of responsibilities. So as a franchisee, you have responsibilities to operate that, you know, business according to what those brand guidelines are. You have a responsibility to provide, you know, the services that the customer expects in the way that they expect, you know, and it's, so for example, there was a pet store franchise in our market who ended up doing some really bad things. And ended up getting shut down. But that being said, my guess is that, you know, that franchisee probably didn't have a lot of oversight, probably didn't have a lot of support, probably didn't have someone visiting them to do any quality assurance reviews. So, you know, you're providing, say a maid service, you know, you're providing these services in somebody's home. But there's a level of expectation of what that brand wants you to do and how they want your employees to dress and how they want advertising done. So, you know, it's what I always say, I'm a helper at heart, right? So my previous life was as a social worker. I've always been an entrepreneur as well. But what I love about franchising is it's help somebody else have a livelihood and their own business with a level of support. So, you know, if they're run into a problem with their coffee shop, they have somebody to call and say, hey, this is what's going on. What do I do? And there's some things that franchisors can say, this is what you do. And say, well, here's some possible things that you can do, but it's your decision, especially employment stuff, right? Like franchisors, we stay out of anything employment related because they're not our employees, right? They're the employee of that business. So
you probably get legal advice and that level of, I mean, the value in our business, we have to create our own networks of support, right? And we have to sort of curate like, okay, I trust these, you know, folks in my peer group to give me advice, but the value proposition for a franchise is okay. Like in the co-working business, for example, if you want to start one and you don't want to spend all of the time to figure out how to do it and, you know, how to do it successfully, you're looking for sort of a proven, you know, model in a box that you can invest in. And then you know, you're paying into guaranteed support from a brand, to your point, that's been developed and that you trust to give you the right advice to run your business. But also it simplifies things like, you know, somebody centrally is running Google Ads for you and helping with social media. And, you know, like some of those things that just are real pain points for the local operator are kind of taken off your plate, which is...
Yeah, and they can be. And in some franchise systems, they are. Some, they're not.
Right.
So there's a mixture, but absolutely the point being that there are... If the franchisor isn't at least providing that service, they have a relationship with somebody that does. So the other really advantage about being a franchisee is the economy of scale, right? So, you know, if I'm ordering massage tables to open, you know, a wellness clinic, I'm going to get a much better price because they know they're going to have business from 50 more units that are opening. So as a franchisor, we can negotiate pricing with vendors. You know, we can get better deals on things because of scale. So as the franchise system grows and also building those relationships. So we're going to have a relationship with a Google Ads vendor, you know, and they're going to have a negotiated price. It's not going to be, you know, franchisee going to try to, you know, getting
do it themselves,
you know, to figure it out. We're going to have a recommendation and have a strategy and have all that worked out. So it's really just implementing it. You know, to franchise a business. So if we're talking about, you know, if you want to franchise your co-working space, the most important things are you want to make sure you have a strong brand, right? You want to make sure that you can replicate what you just did.
Right. Your amazing one location may not be
Right. And they, you know, you need proof of concept. So, you know, do you open two more units to make sure that you can replicate it and it's going to work or that it's going to work in a different market? That was the big thing with the pre-postnatal fitness brand that I worked with. I was the first franchisee. I've been a franchisee. I've done franchise sales. I've been on like everything in franchising, but I became the first franchisee because we were in San Diego, Southern California. And I was like, we need to see if this is going to work in a different market. So I was moving to Monterey. And so I was like, okay, so we opened in Monterey and it worked. So then we did 10 beta locations across the country. Is it going to work in a different market? Is it going to work in a different climate? All those things. So in co-working, you know, is it going to work in a large city, a small city, a medium-sized city? What are those metrics that you need to know to have a successful location and can it be replicated there? You need a proven concept. The biggest thing is you need the unit economics to work.
Right.
Unit economics don't work. It's not a franchise. It's not a business that somebody's going to buy into if they can't clearly see a path of those economics working in that model.
Right. And so that, I assume, is part of the sort of legal requirements around franchising. Is it franchisor... you're saying, well, you have to disclose all of your financials and you're not making, I don't want to call it promises, but you're sort of saying like, look, we've tested this, it works. We've got this all packaged up for you. And so the protection there is making sure that that's like reliable enough to sell it, right? So that a franchisee isn't being taken advantage of, that it's like super clear what you're getting, what the history is, what the... I don't know. Can you talk a little bit more about?
Yeah, definitely. So so the FTC regulations require you to provide something that's called a franchise disclosure document. The franchise disclosure document has, they're usually even now, like even our company that's new, that we only have a handful of franchisees right now so far. Our FDD is like 160 pages long, like everything you need to know or ever wanted to know. So it gives you the backgrounds of all of the executives in the company. It gives you audited financials of that parent company for the last 3 years. It gives you every detail of what you will be provided, what your responsibilities would be, what training is like, what training is required, you know, what you need to comply with as far as state, you know, obviously any state and local laws are their responsibility, but insurance requirements, everything that you could possibly imagine about a company is in that FDD. So if you think of a bigger system, like, you know, some of the food brands, honestly, like their FDDs are like thousands of pages long.
Oh gosh.
Because so you're also disclosing a list of all your franchisees and all your past franchisees. So when you get into a brand that has 500 units, you got, you know, a lot of pages of franchisees. And then you also get a copy of the franchise agreement that you would be signing. FDD regulations, you have to hold those documents in hand for 14 days before you can do anything. I mean, it's very specific about what you can and can't do in the franchise space. One of the things you can't do is talk about basically performance representations. And so there's a piece of the FDD. If anyone's looking into a franchise, there's a piece of the FDD that is called an item 19. Now, in that item 19, we are allowed, if we're doing it for everybody, we're allowed to give financial performance information of our franchisees only under certain circumstances. So only, so if let's say I have 100 franchisees, I can give information in my FDD about what those franchisees are bringing in for revenue, as long as I'm doing it for all of them and I'm not keeping out the low performer.
Right. Okay.
High performers. It has to be absolutely standardized across the board how I'm presenting the information to you. So you know, so you can have an informed, I mean, the whole thing about the FDD is just having all the information so that you can make an informed decision about whether you want to invest in this company or not. If right now in early franchise stages, people aren't going to have an item 19 because I don't have any financials to show you. Like I have four units open right now, but we just changed our model. So in changing our model, like I don't have any information to give you. So so people who are buying an early stage franchise, they're really taking a leap because they don't know. They can crunch their own numbers and they can talk to an existing franchisee to get information. But yeah, as a franchisor, I can't say a word about what kind of money they look to make, what they should expect, nothing. It's really them investigating it. If you are looking at a franchise, absolutely you should get your own franchise attorney to look at the agreement. You should, you know, work with your financial advisors to look at, okay, so let's do a business plan. And that's the other thing too, as a franchisee, have your own business plan. You know, it's you are a business owner with your own business plan operating a franchise.
So a brand that doesn't have many locations, to your point, what are they selling then? So they're not really selling like a proven experience. They're selling sort of the brand and the aesthetic and processes and the concept. That's
interesting. You're selling an idea. You're selling the concept. You're selling a dream, really.
Yep.
You know, I mean, most, you're going to have at least a couple of units open, whether they're on your own corporate units or something closely held as a proof of concept.
Yep.
So yeah, you're selling the idea and you're selling the promise of something bigger than you could do yourself, right? Like it's the brand, the branding is hugely important. If you don't have a strong brand, like why is somebody going to sign on to you? What are the advantages for them as a franchisee to sign on with a new, you know, an early stage concept?
Right.
You know, if it's not a really compelling story and a compelling brand and a compelling financial opportunity, you know, they need to see that there's hope and that there's, you know, even if they don't know what that exact ballpark number might be, they need to feel like there is an opportunity there. So it's the brand, and the brand is your business. I mean, everybody talks about branding, you know, but in this instance, it absolutely is.
And it really is, yeah.
It's your founder that people buy into your founder. They buy into their vision. They buy into their, you know, dream of what they're creating and their life's work. And they're buying your founder, especially in the beginning, because that's the story they want to connect with. And that, gosh, I can absolutely do that.
Right. That could be me, but in my market, I can, right. And you can help me make that happen. So, I mean, one of the interesting things about franchising is you go to the, I don't know what they're called, like franchise shows, like the big events where there are lots of franchisors and there are people who know what they want to franchise, but there are also people who just say, well, I want to start a business. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go to one of these shows and sort of shop around concepts and then figure out what business I'm going to start.
Right. There absolutely are. The biggest one is in New York. It actually just happened. That's the biggest one that happens every year in New York in June. And that's the International Franchise Expo. So the nice thing about those expos actually though, and not even necessarily that you're shopping brands, but there's a lot of education that happens at those expos. So there's always a schedule of workshops that happen from the franchisor side, if you're looking to franchise something, or from the franchisee side, if you're looking to invest in something, what do I look for? And, you know, how do I decide? And all of those kinds of things. So there's a lot of that that happens at those events, which is fantastic. Like even, so I have three boys, but my middle son has been very interested in business and franchising. And so he actually asked to go to a show. We went last 2 years ago, actually. And we sat in on some sessions about, you know, this is what franchising is. And this is, you know, how to go about it and how to decide and stuff like that. So that's the huge value. And it's really fun to walk the floor and see all the different concepts because, you know, it's fun because you're like, wow, I never thought of that. Or, another yogurt concept?
Right.
And it is fun. There's a lot of food brands, a lot of samples and snacks at those franchise shows. But I would say that the most valuable piece is probably those workshops that happen there to help you, you know, hone in on whatever, you know, it is that you're trying to do.
Yeah. So would you recommend that expo for somebody who's thinking about eventually franchising their brand?
I would. And then I'd also recommend the International Franchise Association. So their website is franchise.org. And that is an amazing organization. I mean, that's how I've learned all that I know in franchising is through those IFA events and IFA networks of people. There's also groups in most major cities. There's something called the Women's Franchise Network. If anyone's interested in going to some Women's Franchise Network events, there's some very active chapters. And then there's also another group called Franchise Business Network. And those are all volunteer committees, organizations that happen through the International Franchise Association, but in their most major markets, and they're a great place to get to know other people in franchising in your community. You don't need to be a member to attend. It's just an opportunity to get together to talk franchising.
So we probably should have started with this, but there are a few brands that are already franchised in the co-working space. Yeah. I have a little list of those I know of, but I might be missing some. HeraHub Spaces franchise, which is a Regis-owned brand, or was, I think they've been trying to spin that off, franchises.
Yeah.
Venture X, Fueled Collective. Both of those brands have been on the podcast before, if you're interested in them. And then Serendipity Labs. Am I missing anyone?
Did you say Office Evolution?
Oh, uh-oh. I hope William's not listening. or Mark. No, thank you. William's on our PWA board. Sorry, William. Yeah.
Yep. HeraHub is actually not a franchise anymore, is my understanding.
Oh, okay.
Back to a licensing model.
Okay. Yeah. Well, do you want to talk about the differences there and maybe why one would choose the licensing route?
So licensing anything. In licensing, you would license your logos, your trademarks. The big difference between licensing and franchising is that franchising, you can provide support, and in licensing, you cannot. So much less control over a license, where you can give people all of your stuff to use.
Yep.
You can't make them use it the right way.
Okay.
Or the way you intend it to be used. And you can only, the amount of money that you can collect as a license in a licensing agreement is much lower than what you can collect or enforce as a franchise model. So you have much more brand protection in a franchise model. Also means you have much more cost in a franchise model, but you have control over your brand and what happens within it more than a license.
I don't know if this is an easy answer, but if I wanted to franchise my brand, like, what, is there like a ballpark budget for getting set up to do this? Like, or some order of magnitude to help people think about, like, what does that take in terms of an investment?
So phase one, you really look at the legal, you know, ramifications, the requirements, creating that FDD, making sure that you're ready to franchise. The biggest things in that phase one is looking at financials and making sure that you have a business model that the franchisee can make money and that you can make money as well as the franchisor. Now, normally there's a royalty stream of some sort, usually somewhere between 6 and 10% of gross sales is going to go back to the franchisor, and that's going to pay for that support team that's providing your marketing materials, and that's, you know, providing your franchise support and giving you all those resources. So, you know, that revenue stream back to the franchisor is giving you those things to help you continue to operate. So the figuring out if the financial model is going to work and those unit economics are going to work so that franchisee can make a living and still, you know, work as part of a whole system. So I would say between the accounting and financial planning stuff and the FDD work with a franchise attorney, and if anyone wants some recommendations of franchise attorneys, I'm happy to give them a list. So, you know, with legal and everything else, I would say that first phase is you want to plan for somewhere between $50,000 and $75,000 between legal and finance work and making sure that your brand is, you know, make sure you have all of your trademarks on your logos and your brand marks so that you're ready, you know, that you have that protection in place and that you're ready to move forward. And then I would say, you know, initial sales and market and timeline, like you're looking, I would say 9 to 12 months for that first phase of legal. You're also going to be fine tuning your operations manuals and making sure that they're ready to go so that when you do sell one of those franchises, you're able to, you know, make that happen for the franchisee. So operations, you're making sure that's all ready to go. You're, you know, if you're need to figure out your all of your architecture stuff, make sure your plans are ready so that when you do sign that first franchisee, you can, you know, they're going to start looking for doing site selection and build out and all that stuff. So I would say that first phase is, you know, that 9 to 12 months, $50,000 to $75,000. Phase two being your initial sales and marketing of, you know, finding those first few franchisees. And so, you know, that's probably another probably 25 to 50, and then operations, you know, being that phase three of finding, making sure that you get those units open and you get those units humming, because those first few franchise units, they need to be open and thriving, because those open and thriving units is what's going to sell your next five, because those, you know, next prospects are going to talk to those franchisees and be like, hey, how was your experience? You know, what kind of revenue are you bringing in? We can't talk about that stuff, but they can talk amongst themselves. And, you know, you want those first few units to be super, super successful so that, because they're going to help you sell the rest.
Yeah. So back to your point, you don't want to be testing your business model in a new market with your first few franchisees, because if they have a bad experience, it could really ruin your prospects, right? Your ability to sell.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's sink or swim.
And then in terms of timing, I mean, you mentioned kind of budgets, but this sounds pretty time intensive. Like the first year or two, it's going to take a lot of your time to get all these ducks in a row.
Absolutely. And the other big decision to make is, do you want to run co-working spaces or do you want to support franchisees running co-working spaces? It's a completely different business, right? Because you're no longer, you know, operating a co-working space. Your customer is now your franchisee who's operating co-working spaces.
Right. So what makes you tick is, sort of the operations of the unit and the people engaged. You're sort of taking yourself out of that and you're in a different business model.
I think your new customer is, you know, you're now satisfying your new customer who wants to be making money.
Yeah. If you're someone who kind of loves like systematizing and process, and I think being a franchisor probably is somewhat appealing. And then there's a ton of pressure because when someone buys into your model, darn it, it had better work, right? And they want results and they want that support. And so it's not for the faint of heart, I suspect.
And it's fun and I love it. You know, I mean, obviously I'm still in it all this, you know, I do love it. And I, you know, it's
right. I mean, your role probably is to really support the folks that are saying, yeah, I want to do this. And you're like, okay, well, let me, let's make sure we can deliver on what we promise, which is essentially why those legal, all the legal requirements are there to like sort of protect the person who's buying into this.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think, I mean, I'm trying to think of what we haven't covered yet that we would. Certainly there are folks who, so I just launched my last cohort of the co-working startup school in end of March. And I have some folks in there who are thinking about franchising. So they're learning about the model and they're trying to decide, do I want to do this myself or do I want someone to come in and just kind of put it all together and handhold? I mean, it's a real, it's like, you know, to your point, you're still a business owner, you're still an entrepreneur, but how many of the pieces do you want to put together yourself? And the branding piece, I think, is part of it. It's like, it's part of what makes you tick, developing your own brand, or do you want to invest in something that is already, you know, somewhat proven. I think one of the folks in our group who is part of a franchise has mentioned one of the benefits he sees is the liquidity that, you know, if you think you want to sell your business, I would be curious about your perspective on that, sell your business at some point, then you're better off not having an, you know, sort of an individual brand that only has a little bit of equity in your local market. You're better off being able to sell. How does that work? Do you have to sell it to another franchisor?
What is I mean, there's huge advantages in that brand piece. That's absolutely, you know, a relevant thought because, you know, as a franchisee of a brand, you're still your own business, right? Like, so if I'm a franchisee, it's still my business that I'm selling. That new person needs to be approved by the franchisor. They need to go through the same steps that I went through to become a franchisee. So they're going to go through that disclosure period of an FDD. They're going to, but that being said, they're getting approved by the franchisor, but they're buying my business. I'm benefiting financially from selling that business because I've poured in, you know, my retirement savings that got poured into the franchise when I bought it And I've now built my clientele and I've built, you know, my base and everything else in that market. So it's still my business to sell. And then there's a transfer fee that gets paid to the franchisor. So you're going to pay a certain, whatever's in your agreement, you're going to pay a franchise, the franchisor transfer fee to transfer your business license, technically your franchise, you're transferring it to a new owner who has been approved by the franchisor, but you're collecting that money from that sale and just paying the franchisor a transfer fee.
Got it. And the benefit there is likely that you've built a successful business and it may be easier to market the business for sale because it's a recognized national brand or international brand.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
It's much more brand value. You know, if that brand has a national footprint or even a regional footprint, there's much more brand value associated with that name than if it was just you.
Yeah, makes complete sense. So if you're looking at multiple locations or scaling or knowing like, look, you want to build a business and eventually sell, then that may be an advantage as well. Mm-hmm. If someone was thinking about franchising their co-working business, what are kind of the couple of key pieces of advice that you would give them as they consider that decision?
Going back to making sure that the economics work, make sure the numbers work, or it's just going to be, you know, an uphill battle.
And on more than one location.
Yeah, making sure it's going to work. At least one more location. You need to at least prove that you can do it again. So whether that's venture or whatever it is, but I think, you know, that's really key. And the other really, really important piece is making sure you have the right partners and your franchise attorneys and, you know, your strategists and making sure that, that you know, it's you have that team to help you get it off the ground because it's, you know, you mentioned it's not for the faint of heart, but it's also not something that you can do alone. Like it's not a solo, you know, job or, you know, thing that you can do alone. It's something that you need a team to be able to do it. And having those, you know, franchise attorneys that can be your advisors and who've been through it before. And it's important. And I say franchise attorney specifically because, you know, I've been a part of situations where founders have used attorneys that were not specialists in franchising. And let me tell you, it is a different world. And just because you're an attorney doesn't mean you understand franchising. So making sure that you get people that have valid experience, help you make those decisions moving forward and making sure your agreements are buttoned up and that you have the protections you need in addition to what the franchisee, you know, should be allowed to do. Yeah, I think just getting those right people on board with you is huge. And like I said, you know, learn as much as you can, whether it's through IFA or, you know, entrepreneur.com actually has some great franchising articles on there as well. But learn as much as you can and making sure that you're making a sound decision to franchise because it's a very long-term revenue play. You know, you're going to get royalties, you know, 15 years from now, but it's very time intensive in the beginning and money intensive in the beginning to get a long-term royalty stream, you know, later on. And it's a huge commitment. You know, you can't go into a franchise, you can't open a, start, you know, opening franchises in it and not have a long-term commitment to those franchisees because those franchisees are helping you scale your business. They're investing their life savings in what you're doing as a business concept. You can't just all of a sudden up and close. You know, it's a 20, 30 year commitment. So whether you sure, maybe you sell your business as a franchisor or take on investment partners or whatever, but it's a long-term relationship with your franchisees. And it's important that they know that you're in it for the long haul.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like there's sort of an extra layer of like ethical commitment to do that. To your point, you can't just all of a sudden be like, you know what, I'm kind of done with this.
Yeah.
And walk away.
Because now you have 1,500 business owners who are relying on you as their support system, as their brand to do the right thing for one, but also to be there when, you know, just like they were there for you in the beginning. Most franchise agreements are 10-year terms or longer. Wow. Some food brands are 25.
Wow.
So if you're talking a 10-year or a, you know, 25-year agreement, it's a long relationship. So you better have a plan to stick around or have a plan to sell to an investment group or something.
Super helpful. I will make sure to list out the resources that you referenced in the show notes for folks that are interested in learning more. Thank you so much for sharing your experience in this topic. I have like a million more questions, and I'm sure people listening that are interested do, but I think we'll wrap it up there and let people kind of dig around on their own if they have follow-up questions. But thank you so much for jumping in and sharing your experience, your own experience with co-working and with the franchise world.
You are very welcome anytime.
Awesome. Thanks, Susan. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Everything Coworking. Be sure to click the subscribe button so you can stay up to date on the latest trends and how-tos. Until next time.